This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
I'm David Aronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the metaversal mind chamber where you, me, the top experts and a big subject collide and then resolve for 28 minutes. This week, Britons have an anti-maths mindset and it's holding the UK economy back, says the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, who's announced another maths review, this time aiming at involving kids in England studying maths up to the age of 18, whether they like it or not. So is the problem what he says it is? And is the solution the one he proposes? In a world where data is everywhere and statistics underpin every job, letting our children out into that world without those skills is letting our children down. So said Rishi Sunak in January. Earlier this week, he announced a plan to tackle the UK's maths problem. That will start with yet another review to look at how the subject is taught in schools. There was one in 2016, though the Prime Minister has already said he wants all school pupils in England to study maths until they're 18. So, is the problem what he says it is? And is the solution what he thinks it is? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. To start with, I want to find out a bit more about what Rishi Sunak announced on Monday and where it fits into the recent history of government initiatives on this subject. Joining me in the briefing room is Bramwyn Jeffries, the BBC's education editor. Bramwyn, can you just remind us of the main points of what Rishi Sunak said on Monday?
In essence, in his speech, he made the case for maths being the main driver for improving our economic growth through education. And he talked about a very wide range of industries, whether it's filmmaking or healthcare, or even our own financial literacy, how essential it is in a modern society to have a good grip of maths. And unusually, England, and in fact the rest of the UK, don't study maths universally after the age of 16.
And is the same true of Scotland?
The same is true of Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales. It's a legacy part of our system that sets us apart from almost every major economy, wherever in the world you look.
Now, he has set up a review. Who's in charge of it?
They've appointed an expert panel, and actually the composition is quite interesting. They've got a vice-chancellor on there, people running colleges, an employer on there. They've got, interestingly, the chief executive of a charity called Maths in Education and Industry, which has just partnered with the government's own Oak Academy, which is their digital platform for lesson preparation, which suggests that they may be thinking about whether providing ready-made content, for example, might be one of the ways to mitigate the difficulties we have with maths teachers.
One of the things that he famously said, Rishi Sunak, is that there is an anti-maths mindset. Given what we're talking about, can I just ask you, is there any statistical evidence for an anti-maths mindset in this country?
There is no statistical evidence, apart from the fact that we don't study it later. We have poor numeracy amongst adults by international standards. This is a cultural, intangible statement, but I actually think that there is some truth in it. And so do many people who've previously looked at maths education in this country. It's acceptable amongst very educated people to say, oh, I'm not much good at maths. No one would ever say I can't read. And that was the point the Prime Minister was making.
But, Bramwyn, isn't maths the most popular subject at A-level?
It is, and it has been for a number of years now. It's the standout high-performing subject. But if you think about it, everybody takes GCSE maths. It's a core competency that everyone is expected to try and get over that hurdle. A third of the people who sit GCSE maths fail. That means in England they get below a grade four and they have to go into compulsory resits, which have an appalling success rate. Only about one in five, having failed at age 16, will then go on to get their GCSE maths if they take it again in college. You've got the students who are taking maths A level, and then you've got everybody else who just stops maths at the age of 16. Now, you could argue that some of them will be doing physics or chemistry or biology or other subjects such as IT, which might have an element of maths. But for most of the population of 16-year-olds, the GCSE is the last time they do maths.
So we have two problems here. The first problem we have is those who fail the GCSE, and then we have the other problem of those who don't then go on to do the A-level.
That's exactly it. And they're two quite different problems, because at the moment in England, those who fail, if they go on to do a college course, it's a requirement of the college getting funding that they have to resit GCSE maths and again and again and again if they keep on failing. And the pass rate for those that have to go through the compulsory GCSE maths resits is around one in five. It's really poor. If they haven't got it by that stage, doing the same qualification again is not working for them.
Well, that's very interesting. Now, the other thing is, I thought there was a review of mathematics education not so long ago. So what happened to that?
Well, that was a major review looking exactly at this problem at 16 to 18 maths education. It was led by Professor Sir Adrian Smith, a very eminent mathematician, and he made a whole range of recommendations, one of which was to get rid of those much hated by students compulsory GCSE maths resits. He said they just don't work if they keep on failing, and it makes them hate maths more, not love it. And the other thing that he wanted to see was a much greater promotion of what's called core maths. Now, there are core maths qualifications out there. There's several offered by different exam boards. If you look at what they study in core maths, it's very different from the academic maths in A-levels. It's more about understanding basic mathematical concepts in the way that they are applied to other areas of study or to life. So that's financial literacy, understanding percentages, the difference between percentages and a percentage point, looking at things like exponential growth, something we heard about during the pandemic. So it's much more about having a good grip of maths concepts and being able to take them into whatever you're studying, whether it's healthcare, psychology, graphic design for video games, or into your own finances and life.
That previous review, that was just only in 2016, wasn't it?
2016 it was set up, and in 2017 it was published.
What did it say about the principal levers that you would use to improve maths outcomes? I mean, and I'm thinking here principally in terms of teachers.
We haven't reached the target for recruiting people into the initial training as a maths teacher for more than a decade. And that's despite the fact that the target for recruitment has been reduced by almost 40% since 2019.
Can I make sure I understand that? The review suggested we needed more maths teachers, but in the period since that last review, actually, if anything, the position has got significantly worse.
It seems to have got significantly worse, and we do not have enough highly qualified maths teachers, which leads to situations like someone who's got a biology degree teaching maths or a PE degree teaching maths or an English degree teaching maths. This is particularly crucial in secondary maths. There's been a transformation in primary maths and a lot of investment into helping primary teachers teach what's called maths mastery, which is confidently building each stage of knowledge before you go on to the next. And it's sometimes called Singapore maths, a facility with numbers that is embedded in the Singapore system. So there's a lot of investment and real change has happened at primary level. But at secondary level, we have an absolutely critical shortage of enough highly qualified people available to teach.
Is the irony here that such is the requirement for people highly qualified in maths that if you are good enough at maths to be a maths teacher, you're good enough to get a better paid job somewhere else?
So I looked at the data on maths graduates' earnings. We have, uniquely in England, an amazing data set that links the tax records back to what people studied at university. And maths graduates are in the top five years after graduating. So where are they going? They're largely going into the world of finance, accounting. They're going to work for big multinational corporations. Those jobs don't only offer a much higher financial reward, they're also increasingly post-pandemic offering something different, which is the ability to work any place, anywhere, anytime, to be highly flexible. Which schools absolutely do not. If you can work 2 days at home, 3 days at home, why would you want to have a job where you have to be in by eight and maybe not leave till six and be dealing with a whole pile of kids in the meantime?
Brian Jeffries. The Prime Minister also said that the UK is one of the least numerate countries in the developed world. To dig a little deeper into that claim, we have Andreas Schleicher, Director for Education and Skills at the OECD, which runs the famous Programme for International Student Assessments, or PISA tests.
The UK ranks quite poorly when it comes to numeracy skills in the adult workforce. It's looking better for children and youth, but I would say if you look at the workforce, the UK has a long way to go.
So the adults are doing badly. What about people just coming out of school now or in school now?
Well, I can only talk about the 15-year-olds for which we have comparative data through PISA. And at that level, the UK ranks quite okay. But really, the issue starts after the age of 15, when different from most other countries, mathematics and numeracy in the UK become optional selective choices. And then you see sort of people dropping off.
Right. Let's go back to the comparisons for a moment. Roughly, if we look at other comparable countries at 15 and then again at 18, how are we doing in comparison to them? Let's take a few like Norway, Germany, France and so on the one hand, and the United States.
The UK does better than the United States at age 15, comparable to France, a little bit worse than countries like Germany and Norway. But it's doing above the OECD average. So I do think the level of math outcomes at age 15 are okay. And also, as I said before, we have seen improvements. And that's, I think, a good sign.
What do you attribute the improvements to? Is it better teaching?
Yeah, I think for younger children, mathematics has got more importance. I think there's been greater focus in the mathematics curriculum, putting greater emphasis on conceptual understanding in mathematics. And this is starting to play out in the results as well. But once again, you know, that is up to the age when mathematics is compulsory. And in later ages, you have a significant share of young people in the UK who do not pursue those kind of studies.
Well, that's very interesting. What do other countries do after age 15, countries that perform particularly well in maths?
Well, and it's not only the high performers. I think in most OECD countries, mathematics is viewed as one of the core subjects that every student pursues up to the end of compulsory schooling, with different levels of emphasis. And it's not A-level mathematics. I think that's a very important point. If you want to educate everybody in mathematics and numeracy, you obviously need to offer a much greater variety of ways of studying mathematics. A-level in the UK would be the very academic way of studying it. But in many countries, you have, you know, more applied ways of working on mathematics, ways that engage learners from different backgrounds with different interests and so on. So you can see a great variety, but you find very few countries where you could sort of drop mathematics from your learning.
That's very interesting because for us, as you say, to continue mathematics learning at post 15 is usually to go to the A-level route. What are the other forms, therefore, that these other countries have of post 15 mathematics?
Well, you know, it's just a broader range of offer. You could study mathematics in an academic way, you know, focusing on the pure mathematics as you do on A-level math, but you can also study it in applied ways. You know, how do you actually use mathematics to solve daily problems? How you actually translate real-world problems into the world of mathematics, using mathematics as a tool. And that is quite popular way and also very engaging way, particularly countries that have a lot of skills-based learning. They do place emphasis on those applied ways of learning mathematics. It speaks to a lot more people.
Do you mean, for example, that you might have a sub-A-level kind of subject in an area like applied statistics, where you try to make statistics fun? Is that something that countries do?
For example, it could be statistics, you know, it could be many forms of mathematics actually play out in real life. You know, exponentials tell you something about climate change and a pandemic. And so understanding those concepts, bringing them into the real world, making them tangible, those are very, very important emphasis. You can use project-based learning environments to have, you know, young people figure out mathematical ideas and concepts. They're dealing with space and shape, you know, uncertainty, risks, financial education, all of those are really about, you know, mathematical concepts used in the real world. And that's not so common in the UK. Most of the maths is taught in quite abstract ways, and that just turns young people off, and then they don't choose it to pursue. If you, you know, ask kids in Japan and in China, math is usually or very often their favorite subject. They really like it. It's not just that they have to do it.
Andreas Schleicher. Now I want to look at another claim that Rishi Sunak made in his speech on Monday, which was that poor numeracy is costing our economy tens of billions a year. Is it? Paul Johnson is the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Paul, Rishi Sunak said on Monday that lack of numeracy costs the economy tens of billions of pounds per year. What's the basis for a claim like that?
Well, there's lots of ways you can make that sort of calculation. I think this one was done by comparing the kinds of wages that people with decent levels of numeracy get relative to those with lower levels of numeracy. You can do it by all sorts of other comparisons, by looking at the grades that people get at GCSEs, whether they get A-level maths or what have you. And it is absolutely the case that people with higher levels of maths education do on average earn more than those with lower levels of maths education. And indeed, the best predictor of your future earnings at age 16 is the grade you got in maths at GCSE.
But how does it help you as a country economically, as opposed to your individual earnings, if you were to have more maths? I mean, can we say that a country which is more maths literate is a better earning country, is an economically more successful country than one that isn't?
You can certainly say that a country with higher levels of education and skills generally will be a higher earning country generally, because people bring greater levels of skills and abilities into the workplace that may well allow them to be more productive because they're using better levels of technology. It may allow firms to train them more to higher producing types of roles. Now, maths is only one part of that, but it is an important part of it. And if you have got a, broadly speaking, keep everything else the same and raise skills in maths, then broadly speaking, you would expect over time, this is not something that happens immediately, but over time, you would expect the economy to do a bit better.
So, for example, a company considering where it's going to invest might say to itself, we're more likely to get the kind of people we want, and those are more likely to be people who are maths literate in this place, which has put some emphasis on it, than this place that hasn't.
Yes, and again, that's true of education generally. Firms will look for workers who are better educated or better skilled in the very particular technologies or skills that those individual firms need. Maths, but also literacy and obviously computer literacy and all sorts of other things are a basic building block for that. And it's not only that firms are more likely to locate in those sorts of situations. We know for sure that firms spend a lot more on training people who are already well-trained and well-qualified. So the last thing you want is to go into the workplace with very poor levels of qualifications, whether it be in maths or anything else, because if you go in with low qualifications, you're the person who needs the extra training, but you're exactly the person who companies aren't going to waste their time training.
So here comes the googly I'm going to bowl you.
Oh, dear.
How does that apply, given the economic success of the United States, which, as we've heard from the OECD, actually has pretty low levels of maths attainment?
Well, what you see in the US is obviously also very, very wide distribution of both attainment in maths and attainment in education generally, and a very wide distribution of earnings. So you see that average incomes in the US are higher than they are here. Incomes in the top 10% are way higher than they are here, but actually incomes in the bottom half aren't any higher than they are in Europe. And indeed, if you're in the bottom group of earners in the US, you're doing less well than the bottom group of earners in Europe generally. Now, that's a whole range of issues driving that. Lack of minimum wage legislation, a generally kind of freer and harsher labour market, but it is also because the US has, like we do, a long tail of people who are very poorly numerate and very poorly literate. So that actually fits quite well with what we know about what is good for individuals. What's good for the country as a whole also depends on the distribution, not just the average.
So an intuitive summary from this is the more highly educated your workforce is across the piece, the better off you're likely to be.
Absolutely, that's exactly right. Now, obviously, all sorts of other things matter. This isn't the only thing that matters, but right across the developed world, there is a clear correlation between how well-educated the workforce is and how equal that education is to the performance of the economy, to people's earnings and to the distribution of earnings within the economy.
Paul Johnson, so yes, we have a problem, albeit a slightly nuanced one. So now I want to find out how we get better at maths. Joining me in the briefing room are Emma Lark, Associate Dean at the Ambition Institute, which is a national education charity aiming to help teachers enhance their skills, and Rob Easterway, author of maths books and director of Maths Inspiration, a national programme of popular maths lectures. Rob Easterway, Rishi Sunak says that he wants more children studying maths until they're 18. If you had the job of improving numeracy in the UK, is that where you'd begin?
This is a huge issue, and it's a matter of what we can do that has an impact quickly. And I think we need to do something at school. And I do actually think that the age group 16 to 18 is one of the most important ones for that. Not least because you get to 16, you might be trained up in all sorts of mathematical techniques. And then a lot of students just forget by the time they're 18 and they need it. So I would invest in some sort of accessible course. And there's an existing course we'll talk about more called Core Maths. Some aspect of that that is, if not compulsory, as many people do as possible. And it needs three things. It needs publicity. I bet most people listening to this have never heard of it. And schools need incentives to actually do this. And that means resources. That means enough teachers. And pupils need an incentive to do it too. Why should I do more maths? So you can sell it to them saying how important it'll be. But in the end, if there were university points you could gain for it, then they've got a tangible outcome.
In general, Emma, would you agree with that?
I think we've got to really look at how we support teachers teaching maths up to the age 18. We know that through high quality professional development, teachers can keep getting better. And that's the thing that has the biggest effect on pupil outcomes. We've got lots of really great evidence at the moment, like recommendations from the Education Endowment Foundation, that have really supported our understanding of what effective teaching looks like. So access to evidence-based professional development for teachers teaching maths through primary and secondary, I think, is a really important part of addressing the issue.
Right, so that's some of the ways of doing it. But let's go back to this question, what core maths actually is. So most of us have a model in our head, which is if we go through our GCSEs and we want to stay onto A-levels, and most of us do, we take three A-levels and so on, and those are the subjects we'll get half of us into higher education to do specific courses. What does core maths do that is different to that model?
Well, two things. Firstly, it's not a full-on A-level. It's, crudely speaking, like a half A-level. It's a level three qualification. But it also ticks the boxes of what so many people say they want out of maths education. It's about interpreting data. It's about some basic financial math so you understand how tax works. It's about estimation, it's about statistics and understanding that in the context of real world. So it's a very practical, hands-on, I know why I'm doing this kind of course.
Okay, so but how would that fit into a current curriculum?
At the moment, schools who offer it would offer it as three A-levels plus this. Core maths is one thing you can take, or you might take what's called an AS level. They've almost disappeared. They're like a half A-level. Or there's something called an EPQ, which is an extended project qualification, which gives you a chance to explore something on your own. So these are some options that are there in some schools. But then it's a matter of if a school's going to offer core maths, you need to have teachers who can teach that. And that is a major problem at the moment.
Emma, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it might be worth considering how we support students that don't achieve a standard pass at GCSE, so a grade four or above. Those students aren't as well suited to the current core maths qualification. And I don't think resitting GCSE is the right option for everybody. So perhaps in that 16 to 18 space, looking at some kind of slimmed down numeracy course to really support those students to become confident with the kinds of numeracy skills that would be useful to them in their day-to-day lives could be better.
Another aspect of this, Emma and Rob, has been the notion that we are in some kind of way an anti-mathematics society, and that this bleeds through into our attitudes towards the curriculum and the way we teach and so on. And Rishi Sunak has said that. Rob, do you think that's true?
Short answer, yes, I think anti-maths does exist. But the word maths is a problem because it conflates two things, a wide spectrum, really, from basic numeracy, working out percentages, to much deeper stuff like trigonometry, which is more intellectual and academic or whatever. And people just call it maths to suit their own agenda, or people just pick out the definition that suits their agenda. So there's two types of anti-maths. One is the I'm hopeless at maths and people like to boast about it. And I think that's often a defense mechanism. I think people are often better at numeracy than they like to say. Just they don't want to be tested on it in front of other people because they're going to get it wrong, they're afraid. But then there's also an anti-maths. Why did I have to study trigonometry, surds, all these things for so long at school because I've never had to use it since? And it's a very valid question, which we have to have good answers for. And things don't have to have a point, because what's the point of history? You can take this to any subject, but you've got to want to learn and have an environment where people can see I'm enjoying this, even if it's just about intellectual development.
Emma, do you find this amongst teachers, that there's a certain reluctance to engage in maths because of a lack of confidence in their own ability?
No, I don't find that amongst teachers. I think teachers are really great at showing pupils that there are so many opportunities to enjoy maths, have fun with maths, and most of all, be successful in maths. Maths is a really great subject because it gives people the opportunity to be 100% right. It's a great, it's a great feeling to unpick a really challenging problem and get to the answer. And as a teacher, you can teach 30 pupils, all 30 pupils can have the right answer. So there's lots of opportunities to build students' self-efficacy by giving them lots of opportunity for success.
Rob, if there was one thing that you could do to improve the mathematics outcome at every level of society, starting in schools, what would it be?
Well, let's think what outcomes we want. We want a society where people can communicate, they can problem solve, they are creative, and they can handle numbers, data, because there's so much of it around. And lots of subjects can deliver that, but maths plays a core part in really understanding why it works. So perhaps there's not enough accessible statistical teaching goes on, and maybe a little bit too much abstract, higher level maths for teenagers who really can't engage with it.
I think I challenge on that a little. Maths as a subject is really broad and in its nature quite hierarchical. So you need to have understood one idea before you can move on and build on it. So a lot of the maths that we talk about that's really important for people going into their careers to know is kind of the foundations. And if gaps open in people's foundations early, then it becomes really hard for them to build on. The algebra and the geometry and all the other stuff in the maths curriculum supports young people to build a really strong foundation across the breadth of the subject. And it gives young people the option to continue to build if they want to study that subject at A level, or to use that knowledge in a more specialised way in vocational study or in their career. But it's really important we give all pupils the opportunity to enjoy and study the breadth of mathematics.
Emma Lark there with Rob Easterway. My thanks to them and Branwyn Jeffries, Andrea Schleicher and Paul Johnson. And my conclusion, it's a great idea, as it always has been, to improve the nation's mathematical skills, but it certainly needs resources and probably a reform of our system of qualifications. And as things stand, neither are guaranteed. We at The Briefing Room will be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight and Claire Bowes. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by Graham Puddyfoot. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon, but if you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to our podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue, including the one about whether we should worry about the AI revolution, the one about how we fix Britain's railways, and the one on the threat posed by avian flu.
What happens when a life coach takes over your life? For the last 18 months, I've been investigating claims that a UK mentoring company is actually a cult.
What we're doing is helping human beings actually gain control of themselves. Not for us to gain control of you.
I don't know who I am anymore, though. Absolutely no idea.
The only money he had to give them was his house.
Controlling its members.
It was more about apportioning blame to my parents.
These toxic groups called families.
Intimidating critics.
When I'd ask questions.
They said, if you leave and you turn against us, we have all those personal recordings of yours.
We'll come for you next.
How do you feel, Paul, about the fact that so many people think you're running a cult?
We're not running a cult. Because they don't know what a cult is. They're slurring us. They're smearing us.
I'm Katrin Nye, and from BBC Radio 4, this is A Very British Cult. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.